So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm David Hampton, and normally you would hear a voice that says, and I'm Nate Larkin, but Nate is in Florida, and so he has absolutely no sympathy from any of us here in the studio today because we resent him. Nate, we hope you guys have a much deserved great vacation. You have been working really hard, and you deserve to be in a nice warm place where there's sun as opposed to where there is wind and rain here today in Middle Tennessee and Greater Nashville where we all live. And Rex and I are here and we're excited about our guest today. We have a guest. Her name is Constance Rhodes, and she has an organization called Finding Balance. And we're going to talk about eating disorders and food issues and body dysmorphia and some of the things that in sobriety circles we don't get quite as much attention or give attention to. And we're going to learn some interesting things from Constance today because she's very trained and renowned in this area, but she has a couple of books out we're going to talk about. And how to help the people we love when we see them struggle, and even maybe to become aware of some things that we acknowledge and reward in people that might actually be contributing to them staying in their destructive behaviors. So you don't want to miss this. This is going to be a really interesting discussion, and that this is not just a female issue, folks. We've got young males and young adult males that are very affected and impacted by their relationship to food and body image and what our culture is saying to young men as well as young women now. And so there's some really interesting things to talk about with Constance today. So stay where you are. We'll be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And our guest today is Constance Rhodes. And Constance is a sort of a peripheral friend to the podcast in that she and Nate did a tour together, a speaking tour together. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. It was called Sex and Skinny. Is that right?
Kind of crazy, but yes.
That's a great place to start. But Constance is the founder and CEO of Finding Balance. And we're going to let her tell us a little bit about what that is and what kind of a presence they provide in the world of eating and food issues and compulsive behaviors where that's concerned. So much of our broadcasts have been substance-related and behavioral in the sense of sex addiction, things like that. But we haven't really talked about food issues because as two men, I don't know if we know how to do that, Constance.
Yeah.
And it's not because it doesn't affect men,
yeah,
but we don't know how to talk about that. So I want to touch on that. But she's also authored a couple of books on Waterbrook Random House. One is Life Inside the Thin Cage, and The Art of Being is the second one. The second one.
Yes.
Okay, great. And then she has a 12-week curriculum called Finding Balance with Food. And I want to hear about all that. But Constance, first, tell us about you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my very short story is just growing up in a home with, we didn't know that it was addiction at the time. It was food addiction. My mom had a pretty serious eating disorder. And when I was 16, I moved from Michigan to Dallas to go to a little Bible college. And I began to wrestle with some of the things that I think you guys talk about on this podcast. Loneliness was a big thing for me, disconnection from people. And I began to connect more with food, you know, as a way to just kind of fill this huge void that I had kind of navigating this adult world as a young person. And I find myself in the middle of an eating disorder in those years. And this was a long time ago. So there weren't a lot of resources or any, you know, there was not the internet. There was not access to figuring out why am I doing this behavior. And my whole life just became consumed with the shame I felt for all the weight I was putting on, and then the pain, physical pain sometimes that I felt from all the binging I was doing, and the loneliness I felt from hiding out. And anyway, in the midst of all of that, I actually was in a little singing group at the college, and we were touring in Europe. And women would come up for prayer at the end of our concerts, and through a translator, they would be saying they had eating disorders. Now, this was 1991. Again, this was not a popular topic back then. And I remember just feeling and knowing that one day, you know, I would be working in this area. Well, I came off of that tour and ended up just kind of living some wild years in Dallas. And then I decided I was going to be the next Amy Grant. And so I moved to Nashville. I'd actually had a lot of meetings with labels, and things were going well, and I was on the track. And then I had a showcase here, which is where you invite all those labels, and you know they love you, and they sign you, and you're famous the next day, right?
Yeah, of course.
That's the script that was in my head. And the showcase was a complete failure. So it was a combination of things, but mostly I'm just, I'm kind of a singer, songwriter, piano girl. And I had all this band with me, and there was all this noise in the room, and it looked like I couldn't sing. Like it was such a humiliating blow. And a year later, I ended up getting a job in the music industry instead. And so I started marketing artists, working with artists, you know, learning how to brand artists. So image and all of that was a huge emphasis of the work I was doing there. And meanwhile, this eating disorder, which had turned into more of a restrictive, so that's the more attractive type of eating disorder to have, that was really in that environment enabled for me anyway, triggered also just because everything was so visual and image, and that really drove me further in that disordered eating. And so what ended up happening was, you know, when I was around 28, 27, 28, realizing, man, this is a life-controlling issue. And I remember the day I was in a counselor's office and realized it had been 10 years since these struggles had begun. And one of the first things I did to get well was go to a little group with community. Now, they weren't eating disorders, and I, you know, I thought I was all cool because they were all messed up, and they were old, and I was in my 20s. But God really worked through that community. And today, in the work that I do at Finding Balance, community is a core component of how we help women find freedom from food issues and just help serve that whole area, which, by the way, is a pretty big issue. So, you know, porn is a big issue, right? Nate and I, when we did Sex and Skinny, he would hit porn and I would hit the food issues, because the reality is that 3 out of 4 women and a lot of guys have food issues of some kind. And so if you want to talk about the two primary easiest issues for people to struggle with, it's going to be porn and food. And so it's good that you're having me here today, because it's like, it's a big issue that no one's talking about. And it, maybe it's not as, you think about opioid and you know, there's very serious implications with that, right? And the food issue, kind of like porn, is more of an undercurrent issue where you're trapped and you don't know what to do, but you know, it can sort of stay masked under there for years.
Well, and so, Constance, I work in the addiction recovery field, and I see women who will tell me, you know, they come to me with what they are, what they're initially presenting is, you know, a substance issue, usually alcohol in the cases of people that see me, but sometimes other things. And they'll tell me, you know, about their alcohol issue, substance abuse. And then we get into sobriety. We get into, they may even do inpatient treatment. And then they begin a few months down the line to come in and say, well, there's this other little part of my story I didn't tell you back when we were so focused and hyper-focused on, you know, my drinking, which I'm trained to always know that most addictions are cross addictions and they're dual diagnosis stuff to look for and all that. But I like for people to begin to tell me as it unfolds, because there's usually a primary thing that's running the bus at the time. So I'm getting to this place here in my question where they're going to tell me that, you know, their bulimia kicks back in their sobriety from another substance. So what's happening there?
Yeah. Well, you know, like you said, so you'll have a primary solution. That's how it feels to the alcoholic or the drug addict. This is a solution, right?
Right.
Alcohol is solving a problem for me. It's helping me forget my pain. It's helping me not think about how lonely I am, right? It's a solution.
Right.
It's a faulty solution. It doesn't last long and it causes other problems. So when you begin to find freedom from that solution or poke holes in that solution and go, oh, this solution is actually hurting me more than helping me, so let me remove this solution.
Right.
Well, you still need time to continue processing the trauma, the pain, the loneliness. So naturally, without even thinking about it, you're going to turn to the next solution that has served you in the past, right? And so that's what's coming up. So it's actually could be a positive thing in a way because you're like, oh, if this is rising up, what, you know, what function is this doing for you?
Right.
And how, what solution is it promising to provide? And then we begin to attack the reality of that solution and measure it against the additional problems that it's creating, right? And then begin to come through that. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? That it would just linger under there.
Yeah.
Until you take the other solution away.
You remove one security blanket and we don't give anybody anything back.
Exactly. You have to give something back.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me because I don't know as much about this issue as I wish I did when it comes to the culture of people trying to recover from it. Because when I get into people with serious food issues, I refer them because I don't want to be, you know, taking the approach that I would with someone with a substance use disorder and assuming that the mindset is the same. So, for instance, do you find that people dealing with food issues and eating issues are as all-or-nothing thinkers and black-and-white thinkers and perfectionistic thinkers as a lot of people that deal with other substances?
Yeah. Okay. So one of the interesting things about food issues is this. The continuum of why people do it and what function it is providing for them is perhaps wider in some ways than some other addictions. Let me give you an example. I have known women who purposely overeat so that they will purposely gain extra weight so that they're unattractive so that they won't be abused again. But I have also known women who purposely undereat so they can lose weight and become super thin so that they will be noticed by men. You can see, same thing. It's food or restricting food. It's my body, but completely different functions. And so then within the different types of eating disorders, so you have on the anorexia side or restricting, there's a huge control piece. There is a lot of black and white thinking, and what we know scientifically is happening in the brain is the more that someone restricts their food, the more they can actually even develop OCD types of behaviors,
right?
Which is even more black and white thinking.
Right.
But your person battling bulimia, well, now that's a very volatile, that's a very up and down, like I'm binging, and I'm all out, and then I'm going to try and, you know, I'm going to try and rein it back in, which is a whole different mindset. You feel out of control. You actually kind of want freedom from that, where with the anorexia, you kind of feel safe.
Right.
And then you've got just general emotional eating, you know, and I'm overeating, but it really feels good, and I would say, the men are underreported with food issues. I think a lot of men are more in the I love to eat. Mm-hmm. I want to eat more.
Yeah.
You do have men with eating disorders for sure, but I think that there are different factors going on with guys. Mm-hmm. And so then you're like, I'm eating for comfort and I know it's not great, but oh, I'll just do it one more day. So do you see how there's such a continuum?
Right.
And it really is important to be able to get into with that person again, yeah. What function or what is this security blanket, to use your term, Dave? How is this functioning for you? So in my story, you know, more on the restricting side, mm-hmm. although I had the crazier side, on the restricting side, it made me feel safe. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about why you need to feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you begin to unfold these issues and you start seeing where in the continuum people are kind of lining up, how much of this is even body dysmorphia that the culture imposes upon us? I guess what I'm wondering is, I hear a lot of what I think is a misunderstanding about eating disorders, in that it all stems from body issues. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe from hearing what you're saying to me, that's actually the case.
Well, what I think is true, and I think is kind of what you're saying, you can't say that everyone with food issues has them because they want to look like a model.
Right.
Okay. However, all of these issues have a body component, mm-hmm. because what's happening is the body has become a place of trauma in some cases. Mm-hmm. It's been a disappointment. Mm-hmm. It's been a trophy, mm-hmm. All these things. And so there's also a huge amount of disconnection, dissociation mm-hmm. from our minds,
yeah.
from our bodies.
Yeah.
There are the pervasive images that we all see within the media. However, there's a huge range mm-hmm. of shapes
uh-huh. yeah.
that are popular. If we gave names today of who people are going into their plastic surgeons and wanting to look at, which mm-hmm. I happen to know what the name is today, mm-hmm. then a year from now, mm-hmm. when somebody listens, it would be a different name and a different
right.
body type, right? So we do objectify bodies. And so there's all of that confusion, and yet there's even a range.
Mm-hmm.
But really what it comes back to is, can I accept my body as it is, what size it is,
mm-hmm.
what shape it is, what elements might not look the way that I think they need to look. Can I find peace with that? Not
yeah.
that I have to love everything about it, but can I choose to love the body in a practical mm-hmm. way and believe that my value isn't dependent on me manipulating this body in a particular
right.
way?
Right, yeah. Now, this may be something you guys approach differently than in other behavioral issues that we deal with. Talk to me about what you, or even do you, use the words sobriety, and what is sober in an eating food disorder? You know, I have a friend that she's suffered and continues to struggle at times, and she said, you know, with you and 12-step recovery, you have a sobriety date most of the time. Someone gives, you know, my sobriety dates, you know, June 5th of 2000 whatever, and she said, I have to pet the dragon 3 times a day mm-hmm. and still learn where I am going to go with this.
Yeah.
And so how do you think yeah. about sobriety in that?
It's such
that context?
An important question. I'm so glad you're asking it. I was telling my friend who's with me, Maren, she's an awesome student learning about eating disorders from Indiana. And in the car on the way over, I think we were talking about this topic of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
So we at Finding Balance do not use that language. It is trickier, right? Because
right.
you can say, I'm not going to pick up another drink.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even say, I'm not going to look at porn,
mm-hmm.
right? Porn might be a better reference than alcohol for this, because you could say, I'm not going to look at porn,
mm-hmm.
and you could still imagine things about the woman standing in front of you at church.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't look at porn,
right.
so you're sober from porn,
mm-hmm.
but because you've been conditioned by porn, you might look at a woman, not even be attracted to her, but mm-hmm. your mind has all of those images. So
right.
were you just now not sober? Right? Okay. Right. So food
or
is
your,
very...
Or your sex life, your actual sex life could be very fantasy-based.
Exactly.
Even though the person you're with...
Exactly.
You know, is...
So how would you measure sobriety? This is where I would think the food would fall, right? You have to eat. It is normal and natural. If you think even back to when you were a kid, anyone listening, when they were a kid, before you had any worries about food, and Christmas or Thanksgiving or 4th of July, some event came around and you ate so much that you hurt, right?
Yeah.
Come on, you unbutton your button on Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah.
So that's overeating. Well, does that person have an eating disorder? Are they engaging in behaviors? No, that's actually normal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So a person who's had an eating disorder before might be walking in more freedom from binging.
Mm-hmm.
And a holiday comes around and they eat more because, man, there was special stuff on the table that I don't get to have all year. Did I fall back into my eating disorder? So then the question becomes, what is your next step? And is that going to life control you? Are you going to leave that Thanksgiving dinner and go home and purge?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to skip eating for the next few days to make up for it? And how long is that pattern going to linger?
Yeah.
So what we're doing with food issues is... it's probably a gradual tapering off.
Mm-hmm.
You may be able to have sobriety from the action of purging, like throwing up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very specific action. But you might find that you're purging in other ways, like maybe now you're extra time at the gym.
Right.
So it really comes back to the how much real estate in my brain and how much of my life is controlled by what I ate and what size I am and what's in the food that I'm eating, and being able to back away from that so that most of the time you are able to eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full, eat foods you enjoy, and not be bound by fear. This is the goal. So I don't see that there's a super clear line on that,
right,
that you can draw like sobriety, but there is a difference in how you're walking through life where this is not the motivating factor for how you're making decisions or how what you think your value is.
Yeah. Do we know, Constance, how this affects your brain, the brain science of something like this, in these kinds of situations? Because you get a physiological response when you deprive yourself of food, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or when you overload yourself with food, the dopamine rush that, you know, may accompany that. I don't know. I'm assuming it would, with especially if, you know, it's a
sugar
binge,
food.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I know with addiction therapy, we are looking more and more at brain chemistry, brain science, what happens to the brain, and how that informs what this person's experiencing, and therefore if we can retrain the brain and, you know, on and on, we can calm the limbic system and, you know, all that, and then we have better results in what we would call our sobriety. But how is the eating disordered individual experiencing something in their brains that might be working against them?
Yeah. Well, so I'm not as schooled in that area as some of my colleagues are, but some of the things that I know are these. You have nutrition, okay? Our whole body is functioning based on what we're putting in it.
Right.
Right? And so when you do overload sugary, fatty foods, there is a pleasure center that is triggered, right? And so there's this really great book. It's a little bit heady.
Mm.
It's called Loneliness. And it's kind of scientific, but they literally looked at people who were lonely. And when they ate these fatty, sugary foods, it helps fill that space, right? Because you get a pleasure bump.
Mm-hmm.
So we know there's pleasure bumps from that. You're right that there's a certain euphoria that can come with the anorexic, with the restricting of food. There's a certain euphoria. People feel really strong and kind of powerful, you know, in that zone. Even though they may feel other negative things, they have that certain euphoria. And so then when you're in a binging pattern, so I went through some years in college when I was binging and eating to the point of what I called in my book a food hangover. That's what it felt like. It really did.
Yeah.
Then all your systems are being overwhelmed by all of what you've just jammed into your body. And then your body's trying to process it out, right? And you feel really terrible. And this can contribute, all of these behaviors can contribute to more anxiety and more depression, which is the after effect. By the way, with binging and bulimia and the purging, there's also a euphoria that comes with the purging action that lasts maybe 15 or 20 minutes followed by that intense anxiety and shame.
Right,
and
like
depression.
Residual anxiety. And
yeah. So you're right, absolutely, that there are all of those kinds of things going on. And so our name is Finding Balance, because mm-hmm. when I was first wrestling with this and I was on a little Christian school, mm-hmm. the answer was, let's just pray about it and it'll go away. Mm-hmm. But we do want to take into consideration, what is your brain? How is your brain functioning right now because of what you've eaten? What are the physical and physiological, biological things that are going on? What are the emotional, mental things that are going on? What are the relational things going on? And what are the spiritual things? Because if we can look at all of those, now we're looking at the whole person that God created us to be, and that helps make some sense.
Yeah.
Of why we feel that urge to binge or to purge or to starve, because that's how our brain has been trained. And you, as you probably know, Dave, neuroplasticity, that term, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
The brain can be retrained.
Right.
And so the hope is that as we ease off of these behaviors and replace them with healthier ones, we can regenerate in our brains and not have to be bound by that behavior, but we do need to recognize that we have a physiological bent toward that behavior if that's what we've been doing.
Right. Well, that's great. I mean, that's a great answer. So if I'm finding myself, and I always tell people, if you think there's a problem, there's probably a problem. I think I may drink too much. You probably drink too much.
Yeah.
Whatever. And so if somebody's listening to this and they're going, I have some stuff that I've been doing for a while that at the very least is kind of questionable to me, and it's probably a secret behavior because that tends to work best. Mm-hmm. We don't tend to do these things in front of people, except maybe we could do restrictive things in front of people and
be praised.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
What willpower you have.
Right.
And that's one thing I want to ask you, because when we praise a person for their dramatic weight loss, or you look amazing, and they're not eating at the party, they're having like one, square of cheese, and that's mm-hmm. it. And we praise their willpower, and we tend to really glorify the person that can stand there and restrain themselves and be skinny and what seems to be self-control. Tell me about what we're actually doing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You're asking really awesome questions.
Oh, good.
We talked about this in group last night, right? Because so the message to the woman who's lost 50 pounds, right? And
right.
she walks into church and, oh my gosh, you look so amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are we really sending that message? Well, first there's the good part, right? Wow, my hard work has, somebody's noticing it.
Mm-hmm.
But the backside of that message is, well, what did they think I looked like before?
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, I better not gain anything back, because mm-hmm. then I'm going to disappoint them.
Mm-hmm.
And what it creates is this additional anxiety, because who knows how they lost that weight?
Right.
Were they doing healthy behavior to lose that weight, or were they really hurting themselves mm-hmm. to lose that weight? And we don't know. And now we've conveyed, A, your body is my concern, because
mm-hmm.
I get to make comments on it.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we say, oh my gosh, you've put on so much weight. we wouldn't do that.
Right.
And yet I've made a comment about your body that tells you that I think I have the right to make a judgment about your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that it looks different than it did before, which means I must have thought something about you before.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever behavior you did to get there, you probably should continue it, because you don't want that affirmation to go away.
Right.
So it is super tricky. So I try, even for people I know personally, and maybe they've done it the right way, I don't go there. I'm like,
Yeah.
There's no way to make that comment without it potentially triggering something else.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side of that, right? So someone who's really thin and really controlled, this was me when I was working in the music business, right? Oh, we wish we could be thin like you. Oh, you have such self-control. What did that do for me?
Mm-hmm.
It affirmed the behavior I was doing, and it made me afraid to stop that behavior
mm-hmm.
because I don't want them to think I don't have self-control.
Right.
I don't want to not be special and be the person that has this extra control. So yeah, we kind of just can't say stuff,
we do assume a lot.
It's not your body's not like my business, right?
Yeah.
Now, when we're married, that's a whole different thing, right? Because our bodies are each other's.
Yeah.
And that's a different territory, and that needs to be navigated carefully as well. But, you know, outside of your marriage,
yeah,
it's not my body.
Right.
It's not my business.
Right. Well, so if I'm at home, and like I was saying earlier, I'm engaging in some things that are causing me to question where I'm coming from and why I'm doing what I'm doing and all of that. And I call Finding Balance. How do I, A, reach you and find you? But, B, what am I going to experience once I kind of reach into your world and say, I'm not sure I'm all in.
Right.
I just kind of want you to, you know, either affirm me or, you know, tell me I'm not as bad as I thought or, you know, what happens when you get that call?
Well, first you should know, so Finding Balance, what our primary space is to create very accessible resources to help people figure out if they have an issue and then to help them plug into community to work through that issue, okay? And so if you go to our website, right on the homepage, it'll say take our self-test, right?
Yeah.
And this is nothing that complicated. It's a very simple, I think we have two of them. You take one and it says, do you want to take the next one? Mm-hmm. It's free. And that self-test has some questions on it to help identify areas where this might, you know, this might be more than just a little thing, right?
Yeah.
So you self-identify first, right? That's the first, do I have anything going on? It's very unthreatening because no one knows, right?
Right.
Now, when you finish that test, you have the option of sending us a little note if you want us to reach out, which we would love to do.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, then, we just recently opened up live chat on our site because we do find that rather than giving us a phone call, people are comfortable to be in their house without being seen.
Uh-huh.
And so I've got people manning that, you know, and, mm-hmm. and you could just start dialoguing with someone. Now, the third thing you could do is look into our Lasting Freedom Online Support Program. Well, you don't have to join that before feeling it out.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have a consultation with someone on our team. And that we're going to do more scientific assessments. We'll look at anxiety, depression, and eating attitudes and spend about 50 minutes talking about where have you been with food and where do you want to go?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll lay out, well, here's how we could help,
mm-hmm.
which for us, one of the most important ways we can help currently is that Lasting Freedom Online Support Program. And that's where somebody says, look, I'm kind of navigating these issues. I don't know what to do. And they jump into a small group that's meeting virtually,
mm-hmm.
so from anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and it's not even that expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to begin journeying with six other people,
mm-hmm.
facilitated by someone who knows what they're doing. And that begins to, again, draw more awareness. And then what we're able to do, because we assess you on the front and back end of each of those 6 or 8 weeks, we could say, hey, you know, you've got this behavior going on, and we really think it would be helpful for you to be plugged in with a counselor. And we want to help remove that barrier to care.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what is it that you think you need? And let us help refer you and, you know, find you that path. A lot of people just don't know what the path is. And it's very overwhelming to start with the counseling piece.
Right.
And so we'll start holding your hand and moving you toward that piece. But ultimately, as you know, David, like they're going to want to work on trauma and deeper issues, deeper than what you do in a setting like our group.
Right.
But you can at least know you've got this backbone beneath you.
Yeah. When is inpatient treatment appropriate?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it, with such a variety of issues, but when this thing is out of control and people are worried about you on the restricting side, if weight loss has been pretty extreme, and what'll happen is you'll hit a mark where it just sort of takes on a life of its own, and you've got to have a good intervention. On the bulimia side, you know, bulimia is a very disruptive and upsetting and violent kind of life to live.
Right.
And somebody who's living in that, man, go interrupt that cycle. What treatment is so good for, it's not to solve all the problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Treatment is so good to interrupt and prevent that cycle. We were talking about the brain and the patterns, right? Sometimes you got to have that pattern interrupted by force.
Right.
By hopefully, you know, voluntary force. Interrupt that pattern, begin to work on some skills, but ultimately inpatient is it's an intervention. It's usually a short-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to continue working one-on-one with a counselor, with a nutritionist, and make sure you have that community piece as well.
Mm-hmm. You told me something interesting before we started recording about the, I don't want to say typical, but the continuum that you were talking about of people that are dealing with this. And it was much different than, I think, the stereotypical answer we all think we know in our heads. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you were asking about ages, right?
Right, yeah.
And it's funny, when I tell people what I do, their very first comment is always, oh, you should come talk to our teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And I'm always like, I really want to come talk to your moms. So in our work at Finding Balance, and part of this is because we don't yet offer a teen program. That is something we plan to do. But I was telling you that the average person we serve has been battling food issues for 20 years.
Wow.
Now, that sounds crazy, but some of the people that we serve, their first experience with an eating disorder is when they looked down at their legs when they were 4 or 5 years old, and they thought it looked fatter than the girl in ballet class, and they started going on a diet because their mom helped them find a diet, you know?
Yeah.
And so they could be in their 20s and still have struggled 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
I would say that a lot of the women that we're serving, they're in that 44 and up range because they've kind of like, they've been battling the issues since college or high school, but then they had kids. And while they had kids, they were just surviving. You know, if we've had kids, that's what we do. We survive.
Right.
And they kind of come out of that survival mode and they go, this is a life controlling issue. This is either affecting my kids. This is affecting my marriage. These are affecting all these other things. And now I'm out of the baby zone. I'm going to go ahead and work on this. And I think I told you that we've had clients as old as 72. And imagine how many years that's been for her, right? 50 years, I think she struggled. And for her, she was in the military and they would check weight. And there's a lot of jobs that do that, right?
Right.
Airline attendants, athletics, and all of those. And they were told in the military when she was in, and I don't know if it's different now, you know, you had to lose that weight in order to stay up to code or whatever. I don't know that lingo.
Yeah.
And so the shame that was produced, well, the food issues that she had were not triggered by the military.
Right.
It was triggered by early trauma. But the military and having to maintain a certain weight and being
reinforced.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you see, it's so complex, right?
Right.
And so what we want to do is say, look, it doesn't matter what age you are. These happen to everybody. Any triggering life event, loss, grief, divorce, a traumatic thing that occurs, your children moving out, emptiness, it doesn't matter. You're going to go to, how do I cope with what I'm feeling now? And it could be drugs, alcohol, food, porn, like it's any of those things.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And there's community for everybody.
Right. Well, so for families, loved ones, partners, spouses, what are ways that we can help treatment-resistant people that isn't shaming them, that isn't saying we're not accepting you, or that isn't commenting on their weight itself, like making the weight or the body issue, you know, but we know something needs to change. We know there's behavior going on, but how do we help interrupt it without exacerbating the problem?
Yeah. Well, as you know, I'm sure, because you're like all certified and stuff. you know, you always want to look at what are the concerning factors. And you're right. Put the size aside, right? Because that's not a hill that they're going to die on, that one, you know?
Yeah.
But if you can say, I noticed that you've been really down. You seem really anxious. I'm seeing you do things that look like they're hurting your body. You know, maybe you're exercising all the time and you're never able to be with family. So you want to look at more of what you're concerned about.
Right.
You know, and talk about those things and be able to say, this is the impact that I'm seeing it have. Your grades are slipping, or you've pulled away from all of your friends. You know, how are you really doing? What are you really feeling? What are you wrestling with right now? How can we help? Right. So that's a good first place to begin. Another thing that I think is super helpful in this area, because again, most people have this area in some way, is to just be like, hey, you know, I used to abuse food. I used to wrestle, like just admitting your own stuff, or even still, hey, I really wrestle with my weight. And I know that I've talked a lot about dieting. And I just wonder, how has that hit you? You know, and being able to acknowledge our part and bring ourselves and our weakness into that conversation, I think is helpful. If the person who's struggling is under 18, boy, that's the time to catch it, even if you have to force it. Now, it's a little bit of a rough thing, because if you force a kid to go get help and they don't want to, well, teenagers are very powerful and able to resist. But if you can get them into someone who will see the underneath stuff and not just over-focus on the food or the size they want to be, which means get them with someone who really knows what they're doing, then what they want to know is, I matter, and this horrible stuff that happened to me and this pain that I'm feeling, there's a solution for it, mm-hmm. and this person really cares about me, they'll continue with that treatment.
Yeah.
If the answer is so focused on, you need to gain weight, we're worried you're too small, well, you're not going to win that fight. But I am an advocate for parents going ahead and taking steps if they need to before those kiddos are out of the house. Just make sure that you're, you know, finding someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because you were saying earlier that, speaking of parents, and, you know, this is something they need to watch their sons for as yes. much as their daughters. In that that you were saying males are experiencing this, but it's not talked about because guys don't talk about this because it's mm-hmm. perceived as this female disorder or
yeah.
concept kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, we live in such an image-conscious world, way mm-hmm. more than when you and I were teenagers, right? And what we've seen with guys is a few things. So one would be athletics, right? Where
right.
particularly in wrestling or anywhere mm-hmm. where they have to make weight.
Right.
You have a legit thing where a coach is saying, hey, you need to lose X amount of weight before the next meet mm-hmm. or maintain this weight, right? And they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're maintaining a weight class and growing, mm-hmm. that's a challenge. Mm-hmm. And the coach may not care.
Mm-hmm.
They might be ignorant and not mm-hmm. know. So that's one thing. Secondly, you have just the general aesthetic of how men are presented in the media, which is every bit right. as physical as women are.
Yeah.
Third, something that I've been interested to see is we have a lot of obesity in our country, a lot of overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen both men and women, young men and women, who grew up with parents who are experiencing health problems related to their weight, so diabetes or other kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they have grown up dead set against ever being in that position. And in their mind, it might even be for health purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I should also note that there is also research saying that health and weight are not always tied, right? You can
right.
be a low weight and be less healthy than a person who's a higher weight. So I'm not saying that everyone who's a larger size
mm-hmm.
is unhealthy.
Right.
But for those kids who see their parents taking insulin shots or wrestling with their weight or carrying around that shame and they don't want it, so they're very dead set against it. And plus organic and eating all things pure. There's a whole eating disorder class called orthorexia for
wow.
that. So they're growing up with all of these mixed messages. Mm-hmm. It is a very common thing for men to wrestle with this. It is underreported. It's considered a chick issue or a gay man's issue,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And so, you know, straight guys don't yeah. want to identify that way, might feel that they can't talk about it.
Yeah.
But we do need to be aware of it. I had a gal in my group last night saying her son, you know, is very, very thin and he has these body issues. You mentioned body dysmorphia earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very specific diagnostic criteria to meet for body dysmorphia, which most people may not meet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But many of us, I even would say that sometimes I'll look in the mirror and see my body differently than it might look in a photograph.
Right.
You know, so all of us have these different views of how we see our bodies on a continuum, and being able to listen to what these guys are saying and not just saying, what, you have nothing to worry about. You're so thin. I wish I was your size back, you know.
Yeah.
And don't disregard it. Just be like, hey, what are you feeling? What are you thinking? How
yeah.
can I help? You know, and open that dialogue.
Yeah. Well, Constance, thank you so much for being here, talking about something that's super important that I don't think we get to hear a lot about. And sometimes in our recovery circles, we get so substance-oriented that we forget about some of the other behaviors and things that other people are experiencing chronically
mm-hmm.
that are just as dangerous to their bodies. How can people get a hold of you that want to further
yeah.
explore this?
Well, the easiest way is just go to our website, findingbalance.com. On there, there's the eating issues test. There's information about our programs. We also, by the way, have the largest video on demand website for eating issues. So we have over 600 videos with doctors, nutritionists, all free.
Wow.
You can find stuff there. And we have a treatment finder for those who are seeking faith-based care.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is at findingbalance.com, the live chat. You can connect with us there. You can find our phone number and all that on
mm-hmm.
there. But that's really the best way to find us.
Yeah.
Oh, and for those who are savvy, our Instagram feed. Like, we put tons of time and intention into our Instagram feed, which is Finding Balance Official.
Okay.
And we use it as a tool to really help encourage people. It is geared a little more to chicks.
Uh-huh.
But It's great content, and it'll encourage you every day. We do it 6 days a week.
Yeah.
So check us out there as well.
That's great. And do you have any more books coming up or anything?
Yes, I am working on two of them right now. One that will go with our new curriculum. We're doing one called Christ Fed, and we've been piloting it here in Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's kind of the small group tool that we would love to see roll out to churches or colleges or other things. So I'm working on a book for that. And then one more after that, which I can't say much about, right? Because I don't want it out there yet until I'm ready to do it. But yeah, and I'm hitting the road again as well, like Nate and I did back in the day. I plan to get back out there and be sharing on these topics in more places too.
Yeah. Well, the world needs your voice. I'm glad you're doing it.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here. And we will be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Well, welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I hope that you enjoyed the interview with Constance as much as I did doing it. She's just such a kind, empathetic witness to this issue, and I appreciated her sharing from her own story and her own past. And it's so interesting how much of these things are just pain management, addiction of any kind, and even with our behaviors and our relationship to food and the way we comfort ourselves with it, the way we use it as a weapon, all those things that she talked about, you know, just the way that we relate to food and ourselves, you know, it's something to think about. Something we can all explore and affects more of us than we think. So I hope that you enjoyed today. And again, if you need help in that area, reach out to Finding Balance. And they can help you with resources, counselors, and help you assess maybe where you are in the process and exactly what the next right step for you is. And so we appreciate y'all joining us today. Nate will be back next time, and we have some great guests coming up, and we're looking forward to seeing you again on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelly, music by Rex Schnelly, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.